Hello, this is Simon Mayer. We've got an extra film podcast for you today. Mark and I have been talking to filmmaker Terry Gilliam about his imminent BAFTA fellowship.
This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Now, we're going to be speaking to Terry because he's going to be awarded this BAFTA fellowship on Sunday. Just explain, while we try and plug bits of wire into other bits of wire, Mark, the significance of being awarded a BAFTA fellowship.
Well, the fellowship is officially considered to be the highest award you can get. It's effectively saying that what you're doing is you're embracing the entire body of the person's work. I mean, in the case of somebody like Terry Gilliam, he is so much a filmmaker who, if you like Gilliam, you tend to have seen all his films. It's not that people have seen one film or a couple of films. You've seen all of them. So actually, the fellowship is, as I said, it's kind of the highest award. It's a matter of saying, OK, well, we take on this entire body of work and we say that all of this is worthy of recognition. And I mean, as you know, I mean, I'm a huge Terry Gilliam fan. I think you are as well, Simon.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, I mean, funnily enough, just this morning, somebody rang up for something and they were doing one of these, can you give us a list of 5 DVDs that every person must own? And of course, you know, top of the list is Brazil, because I can't imagine any house in which they don't have a copy of Brazil, in which it's not just there on the DVD shelves, because you wouldn't want to be without that sort of thing.
You can't imagine a house without a DVD of Brazil, really.
No, I mean, it would be like a house without a copy of Mary Poppins or a house without a copy of The Exorcist. I mean, I just don't know, if you've got a DVD player and you haven't got those 3, what are you doing? Why are you being allowed to have a DVD player?
Terry Gilliam, good afternoon.
Hello.
Imagine that. Apparently, I don't know if there are any. I'm sure Mark can't conceive of any households at all.
No, I like Mark's view of the world. He's always inspiring that way. I mean, he sees the world as it should be, not the way it is.
Yes. It's a slightly disturbing way of looking at the world, though, Terry, don't you think?
No, not when it comes to my films. When it comes to The Exorcist, I agree with you, but not when it comes to my films.
What's the problem with The Exorcist, do you think? Let's have a long chat about that.
No, we're here to talk about me and my body being embraced by BAFTA. Or is it the body of my work? I can't remember which it is.
I think it's the body of your work being embraced by BAFTA. Is this as good as it gets, Terry? I mean, this is some accolade, isn't it?
Yeah, I have to admit, I was shocked, surprised, humbled even, if that's possible, by it. Because when I looked at the list of former fellows, I thought, why me? What am I doing in this august crowd? So whatever is going on, whatever has been in their mind to give me this award, I appreciate it and I don't understand it.
Well, it is just worth looking at that list, which includes Charlie Chaplin, Alfred Hitchcock, Steven Spielberg, Sean Connery, Elizabeth Taylor, Julie Christie, John Barry, Stanley Kubrick, Judy Dench, Anthony Hopkins. Any others to add, Mark, to that? I mean, this is a...
No, but I'll tell you who needs to be added to it in the very near future is Ken Russell.
Of course.
I think Ken
Russell
should be in there.
Shocking that he's not there, yeah. No, I agree with you, Mark. That's absolutely right. Now, it's quite interesting. I don't understand how these things are decided, but it does feel nice that maybe somehow some of these films have actually had an effect on people to the point that they think they're worthy.
Are you part of the British movie establishment now, Terry?
That's what I fear. This is my waking nightmare. I mean, am I establishment? Am I no longer? What's happened to my street cred is what I ask myself.
Listen, can I just say something on the subject of Terry being part of the movie establishment? Recently, like a couple of months ago, I found myself on stage with Terry at a cinema in London because there was the American Academy were honouring his work. It's interesting that these things are all kind of coming together at the same time. Everyone's suddenly waking up and going, yeah, you know, that is a really solid body of work anyway. So there was a lovely evening in which there was clips from all Terry's films, and this succession of people got up to talk about how fabulous Terry was, and it was Michael Palin, and it was, you know, writers, and, you know, very, very sort of high-profile people. And I got on stage with Terry, and within 5 minutes, he was naming names and bad-mouthing Hollywood executives by name on stage in a way that no insider would ever do. It doesn't matter what they do as far as the awards concerned, Terry. You are not going to be an insider if you carry on like that.
Now, the problem is I keep doing this, hoping I'm going to be able to burn bridges, but it's almost impossible to burn bridges in Hollywood, no matter what you say about people.
But presumably, being splendidly indiscreet, Terry, is one of the reasons that people like you.
Well, somebody's got to do this job. I mean, I'm so crazed by the fact that nobody can say anything anymore. And the minute anybody does say something interesting, they're pilloried for it, and or it's taken the wrong way. It's taken out of context. I mean, it happens to me all the time, but I don't see any reason to stop doing it. But I do think we're living in a terrible time of fear of what you might say, that somebody might take offense, because I think offense is a very important thing to continue to try to commit on people. Offenses.
Do you think, Terry, now that you are going to be a BAFTA fellow, that you will be able to have conversations in future when you're trying to finance a movie, which will go, hello, I'm Terry Gilliam, I'd like to raise some money to make a film, and they'll say no, and then you'll say, I'm a BAFTA fellow, and they'll go, okay. So it's a bit like, it's a bit like the American Express card. Will it make it easier, do you think, Terry, to get a movie together?
Yeah, it probably will, and that's one of the disappointing things about humanity, that they're so easily suckered in by awards and honors that they think they have meaning. I still am interested literally only in what I'm doing at a particular moment. The idea of a body of work is actually quite disturbing, because I think I still see myself as a beginner, a novice who's trying to get a career going. And somebody actually thinks I've had a career, even though I didn't notice at the time.
And when you go, when was the last time you watched Jabberwocky or Time Bandits? I mean, do you go back and watch stuff if there are new versions being made, Terry?
No, I don't really. I think I watched Baron Munchausen last year because they did a 20th anniversary edition of it in Blu-ray. So I watched it again, and I sometimes, you know, I don't normally watch my films. They've been so much part of me for so long when I'm making them that I'm happy to get them out of my system. But when I do watch them, I'm kind of surprised, because I think, who actually made this film? Because the guy named Terry Gilliam who made that isn't me anymore. I'm somebody different. And that's what's surprising to me. I think, oh, yes, that's really good. That's clever. And then I look at something else in the film and say, how could somebody be so bad as to incorporate something like that in the film?
So in what kind of way have you changed? What's the difference between a movie that you'd make now? And as you mentioned, Munchausen, that's 88. So what's the difference between now and then?
I think I've got a few more interesting scars, and and I've been through more things. Maybe I'm getting more sentimental in my old age. I'm trying to maybe look at characters in a way that I wouldn't have then, because maybe the films were the thing that dominated and the ideas of the films. And now I'm getting a bit more interested in seeing if I can bring characters alive in a different way, in a more touching way. So maybe that's just old age, you know, sentimentality creeping in.
Mark's got a very incisive question.
Well, I just wanted to say on the subject of sentimentality, I mean, it's interesting. If you look at a film like Tideland, which is actually probably one of your most singular and personal films, and probably of all your work is the least seen one, I mean, that, I think, is a film that you couldn't possibly have made 20 years before, because I think the 20 years of fighting and the 20 years of dealing with studios and the 20 years of having to have those battles with producers produced the kind of the anarchic sense of freedom of Tideland. Now, the funny thing was that when I was on Radio 5 before, I said, look, Tideland is clearly a reaction to what happened with the Brothers Grimm. With the Brothers Grimm, you were sat upon by the studio and they were unpleasant, and Tideland is you getting all that out of your system. And you said, no, that's completely untrue. And I'd like to offer you this opportunity, Terry, to admit that I was right.
Yes, you are. As always,
thank you.
You're right.
Oh, don't, Terry, it's going to be insufferable now.
I'm going to be nice to everybody from now on. That's what I'm going to be now that I'm a fellow. I'm a happy fellow.
And, but that's what makes Tideland such a great film, is that it was a reaction to all that other nonsense. It was like, right, you go and do that, and I'm going to make Tideland.
Yeah,
and that's what you did.
So we have to thank the brothers Weinstein for Tideland.
Yes, in a strange and twisted way we do.
Correct. Because it's funny. I mean, I remember years ago when actually talking to Carol Cleveland's husband at that time when we were doing Python, and he was talking about a friend of his who is incredibly talented as a boxer, and he worked his way up through the system, but he got to the top and suddenly he was champ and he started losing because his boxing was in reaction to what the other boxer was doing to him, and suddenly he was the champ, and suddenly he had to behave in a different way, a proactive as opposed to reactive way. And I'm now beginning to worry if that might happen to me now that I'm a fellow, that I've reached the top of the tree, that my career is actually, you know, It's probably I'm at the top of my. It's only downhill from here. Yes. On in now.
Do you get a badge, Terry, or a cloak, or a hat? Or
I'm
something?
Hoping I get all of those things, and a change of underwear would be nice as well. I mean, so many things that I think there's a terrible responsibility walking around London as a fellow with that weight on your shoulders. So I'm going to have to dress differently. I'll probably have to, you know, shave my beard and do other things. I'm going to have to become respectable.
What's the situation with Dr. Parnassus? Because the last time I spoke to you, you were finishing, but not finished yet. And of course, as I think most people will know, it is in fact Heath Ledger's final role. He sadly died. He was halfway. What's happened now? Because you were saying last time I spoke to you that people who've seen bits of it think it's really something special.
Well, basically, the film is finished except for tidying up a few effects shots, and. We've shown it to, I don't know, maybe 75 people have seen it, and I can't get anybody to say a bad thing about it. It really works. It is really special. It's kind of a work of love, an act of love, and everybody involved in it just poured so much of themselves into it, especially after Heath died, because he had poured so much in before he had. And it's touching, it's funny, it's beautiful, it's outrageous. The strange thing is, it's almost what I set out to make. Because at the beginning I said I'd like to make a compendium of everything I've done, and it's kind of that, with bells on it, to be honest. And it's kind of the best of what I can do. I'm really proud of it.
Terry Gilliam is with us. He gets his BAFTA fellowship this Sunday. Mark Kermode is with us as well. Terry, people will be intrigued then from what they've learnt about your latest film, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. What can you tell us?
Oh, it's not an easy one to sum up, but basically it's this strange traveling group of players who arrive in modern-day London, offering you the chance to expand your imagination, you know, enter the Imaginarium, go through this magic mirror, and let Dr. Parnassus let your imagination blossom is at the heart of it. And that's basically the story. What happens in it gets more convoluted because Heath Ledger appears as a character who we don't know much about, who's basically the cuckoo in the nest, and things start happening. Parts of it are almost like my animation, except it's for real this time. And other parts are very sweet and romantic.
When Heath Ledger died, Terry, presumably there were quite a few people, including maybe you yourself, thinking, can we continue with this film?
Yeah, I mean, I just was ready to stop because Heath was so important to the film, so central and so important to all of us as a friend and everything. And it just took the wind out of all of our sails because this was impossible. There's no way somebody with that much life and verve could be dead, but he is, and he was, and he is. And everybody around on the film just wouldn't let me go home and go to bed and pull the covers over my head. They said, we've got to save this film. We've got to save Heath's last performance. You can't just walk away. And so I got to work, and we rewrote the script quite quickly and then decided that, well, since we had got most of Heath's performance on this side of this magic mirror, and he enters the mirror three different times, let's have three different actors play him on the other side of the mirror. And I called Johnny Depp and said, Johnny, here's the situation. Will you help? And he said, I'm in. And then within a couple more weeks, Jude Law and Colin Farrell had joined the team, and we managed to do it. And they were absolutely heroic because they had to work around other commitments that they had, but they came and they took over. Very brave to do because, you know, you're stepping into somebody else's shoes on very short notice. And it worked a treat. And so we've ended up with this extraordinary film.
And you've all agreed, as I understand it, Terry, to call it a film from Heath Ledger and friends rather than a Terry Gilliam film.
Oh, it had to be, because there was no way I could take credit for that. I mean, Heath's death and what he had sort of begun in his performance created the film that had to be to finish it. I mean, he created so many problems for us and so many strange potential solutions that it shifted in many different ways. So it's most definitely Heath's film, and Heath and friends who loved him dearly.
But it is worth emphasizing again, Terry, as you had just mentioned, that although A lot of the attention went to The Dark Knight because that was the film that was being promoted at the time. When he died, you were in the process of making this film. You were shooting in London. I think you stopped at the weekend. Sunday, you went to Vancouver and Heath went to New York. And then on Tuesday, he died. I mean, you were right in the middle of the nuts and bolts of this film.
Totally. No, we finished on the Saturday night in Clerkenwell. And we all went our separate ways, me to Vancouver, Heath, New York. And he was supposed to be turning up later in the week. And suddenly there on the BBC website is Heath Ledger found dead. And this was an impossibility. So, yes, right in the middle of production, we had to stop everything. I had to rewrite. We had to get Johnny and Colin and Jude on board. We had to convince the money people not to run away and leave us. And we did. And after about a month, we started up again. And we finished shooting in we came back to London the beginning of June last year, and we've been in post ever since.
And you're clearly a huge fan of Heath Ledger's work. I mean, you've said that he would have gone on to be the finest actor of his generation.
Oh, he was extraordinary. There was no competition, really. I mean, he just had everything you ever want in an actor, and more so even in a movie star, because he could take any kind of character and just make it live. He was incredibly funny. He was getting funnier as we went on. One of the great things in Parnassus is I was letting him ad-lib a lot, and he just was just hilarious and surprising all the time. We would sit there in every take and look and say, what is he doing now? Oh, my God, look at that. It was extraordinary. He was just, I mean, he was flying. And
does that happen very much in your movies? Terry, I mean, do you encourage improvisation?
Not like this. No, not normally. I mean, I don't want to restrict and restrain actors. But, yeah, normally we stay pretty close to what's on the page. But Heath was on fire, and so let's do it. And which was interesting because it then encouraged Andrew Garfield, who plays Anton opposite him, who, again, hadn't ad-libbed before. Suddenly he was flying. It was like everybody was energized by this. And I said, we go with it because this is better than what we've got on the page.
Mark.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening now with The Man Who Shot Don Quixote? Because, again, there was a suggestion that you have now got the financing back for it and that great lost project is going to happen.
Well, strange enough, when we finish this interview, I'll be back on the computer rewriting the script. We got the script back finally. Jeremy Thomas managed to untangle it from French and German lawyers, and we have it. And having, you know, I hadn't read the script since the film collapsed, so that was 7 years ago, and I didn't want to read it because I knew we had, you know, gold in our hands. It was the best thing I'd ever written, blah, 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 blah. We get the script back, and the first thing I do, I read it and say, whoops, we've got to do some work here. So Tony Grizzoni and I have dived back in. We started a couple of weeks ago, and hopefully the rewrites will be done by the end of this month, and then we will see where we go from there.
There are all kinds of versions of the Don Quixote story that have been plagued with misfortune over the years. You sure you want to do this?
Yeah, take on a plague any day. Yeah, somebody's got to do it.
What can you tell us about the casting of it, Terry? Was it far too early?
Johnny, of course, is the first person we'll be calling. Johnny Depp. But he's signed up for everything for the next 20 years, so we'll see what that means.
He's on a retainer, is he, to the Terry Gilliam franchise?
No, he signed up to other people, unfortunately, who can pay him much more money than we can. So, but we'll see what happens. I mean, the search for Quixote will have to start again. In a sense, we're starting from scratch. And I was saying to somebody earlier that, in fact, I find myself to be very lucky that we didn't do it then because we're going to make a better film this time around.
So is any of the footage that you shot that's in Lost in La Mancha, is any of that going to appear in the new film, or is that now all part of a project which is gone?
That's the archaeological dig project is what that is. No, that won't be used in the film. So we'll leave it there for film historians to pore over for years to come, trying to describe what the finished film would have been like based on those few fragments that we've made.
John
that documentary did provide a fantastic footage of you standing out in the rain, cursing at the heavens as God himself attempted to wash away your entire movie set, and it was worth it for that moment.
Yeah, I know. Suddenly I felt one with Job. I knew what boils felt like. I knew what the heavens raining down on us felt like. Now, it was very clear at that point that, you know, it was like actually the closest I came to becoming a believer, because there clearly was a God at work, and he clearly didn't like me, so he was almost worth believing in.
Didn't you set out in life think you're being a missionary?
Yeah, but the God that I was being trained to sell didn't have a sense of humor, it seems, so we left him behind.
Right. This is John in Colchester, because I know we have to finish this in a couple of minutes. Last time Terry was on, he was going to talk about the ending of Time Bandits, and he was cut short by the news. Can we hear what he has to say about it this time, please? Because we're a couple of minutes away from the news. His reasoning for the ending has always intrigued me.
The ending, you mean where Kevin returns home and he warns his parents that in the microwave that piece of what looks like meat is in fact evil and they don't listen to him, and for that they're destroyed. I thought that was the way it should be in a children's world, in a child's world. What's interesting about the last shot of the film as we pull back and Kevin is walking towards the smoldering heap of his parents is, if you look closely, the smoke is going the wrong direction, because on the day we had to shoot the scene backwards because the cherry picker we had the camera on was juddering as we rose into the air. It didn't judder when we descended, so we descended and had poor Kevin walking backwards while the smoke rose in the air. But when you see it in the film, of course, everything is backwards. He's walking forward and the smoke is going downwards.
Kilpers in Edinburgh. I met Terry on Red Nose Day in 1988. He was in Edinburgh for the premiere of Baron Munchausen. He came to my school, St. Thomas's, and I was dressed as a Gumby. He gave me a prize, and it was an incredible honour for a 14-year-old film fan. Thank you, Terry. You are a genius.
And that boy grew up to be the man running BAFTA, and that's why I have the honour of being a fellow. Thank you.
And that was Terry Gilliam with Mark Kermode and me. Thanks very much indeed for listening.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.